This is the second day of this November 2013 seven-day session. We'll return to our text from yesterday, a book called Zen Letters, which are the teachings of 12th century Chinese Zen master Yuan Wu, the author of the Blue Cliff Record. For the sake of this is a letter. All of these are letters. And this one begins, "For the sake of this great teaching, the ancients gave up their bodies and their lives and endured endless, immeasurable hardship and toil until they thoroughly clarified its profound, essential message. They treasured it like a precious jewel and guarded it like their eyes. They worked on it assiduously and never let it be taken lightly or defiled. This is the first sentence about what they gave up their bodies and their lives and what they endured, hardship and toil. Certainly from the accounts that have come down to us from ancient times, it can be hard to argue with this. They pursued this matter with such ferocious determination and perseverance. They treasured it like a precious jewel and guarded it like their eyes. Dogen, a century later, Zen Master Dogen talked about honoring this true mind of ours, this essential nature, to protecting it from influences that would cloud it. To do this like you would protect your own eyes. And this is where he got it, that phrase. With that kind of care and attention, watching for thoughts. That's what he means by treasuring it, maintaining this vigilance all the time, not getting lax, not allowing thoughts to take over the mind. Thoughts will come in, they're always coming into the mind, but not letting them get a foothold, not getting involved with them. As soon as the slightest trace of special understanding arises, it is like clouds casting a pall over a clear sky, like dust obscuring the surface of a mirror. Here he seems to be warning us not to make too much of any particular experience that we have in Zazen. And not the slightest trace. We don't want to cling to the slightest trace of anything special. This is a difficult one because everyone, for quite some time, everyone seems to, when you get into a moment of clarity of this realm of no mind, and you have some kind of insight. There is this tendency to think that it is something really special. the slightest thought of that, that this is special, I'm special, look what happened to me, look what I attained, he says, is like clouds passing over the sun, casting a pall, dust obscuring the surface of a mirror. For most of us, it seems that when we have these little affirming experiences of clarity, the thoughts fall away and we're in a state of flow, of oneness with the breath or the koan, whatever it is, we do make a big thing of it, and this generates all kinds of thoughts, and then it's gone because of our thinking about it and congratulating ourselves. And for most of us, I think, we have to go through this several times or more before we finally realize that that's not what we want to be doing, but just to be able to let go of it. It's the hardest thing. We want to have these experiences, of course. We want to have transcendent experiences, peak experiences, moments of great freedom. And then when they happen, Zen calls upon us to let them go. Just let them go. Discard it. Because what is it we're letting go, really? We're just letting go the thought of it. We don't need the thought of it, the memory of it. The next letter seems to be to kind of a farewell letter, someone who's going back. Here's how it begins. The ancients were always mindful of this matter. Whether deep in the mountain valleys or in the bustling villages and towns, they never turned their backs on it for an instant. Whatever scenes or circumstances they encountered, amidst sound and form, in the course of movement and action, they invariably turned around and focused back on their own selves. The practice of all the practitioners since time immemorial who completely penetrated through was none other than this. They invariably turned around and focused back on their own true selves. Linchi put it very simply: on the outside, cut off all attachments. On the inside, make your mind like a mountain and enter the way. This is the essence of Zazen, is turning attention back to the mind itself. And not allowing it to dwell in the objects, external objects. And external objects always includes thoughts. This is how we've used or misused the mind for lifetimes, is getting caught up in things, thoughts and other things. Objects. This is the radical nature of meditation, is to instead turn the mind back and look. whether deep in the mountain valleys or in the bustling villages and towns. We could say a modern version of this, whether you're in a huge shopping mall or in heavy traffic, to maintain this awareness. Again, back to what we read just a minute ago, to treasure it, treasure this awareness. This is really what the precious jewel means, is our native awareness, our essential awareness. Thus, with their fundamental basis firm and strong, they were not blown around following the wind of objects. They were serene and at peace, and did not fall into the scope of feelings of holy and ordinary. They came directly to great cessation and great rest. They found the seat and put on the robe. That's in quotation marks. They found the seat and put on the robe. Roshi Kapila would sometimes say that we want to find our seat in all circumstances in our lives. It really means finding our center, maintaining our center. Not getting swept up in the winds of thought. Wind seems to be one of those analogies that crops up quite often in Zen texts, and we have this concept, I think, not just in Zen but in Buddhism generally, of the eight winds. And the eight winds are four pairs of, well, rather than describing it, I'll just read them. So these are the eight winds: gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and censure, pleasure and displeasure. So someone a long, long time ago, many centuries ago, identified these four pairs of circumstances or that can wreak havoc with our peace of mind: gain and loss. This can, of course, can mean in terms of money, but other things as well: property and friends, relatives, fame and disrepute, or fame and shame. Is a huge one that is common to just part of human nature. Praise and censure, or praise and blame. This is a real test for anyone to see how she or he reacts to praise or blame, censure. And of course, good old pleasure and displeasure, endlessly trying to grasp what is pleasant, so whether what we want, and avoid what is unpleasant, what we don't want. And then he says, now you are returning to your home village, able to see as the ancients saw. So apparently this is the recipient of the letter is someone who had some kind of awakening. If you can make it continuous and unbroken, how will it be any different than when you were in the monastery being guided by the abbot and doing your meditation work? If you turn your back on it all and there is some break in the continuity, then you will lose contact. We are about to part, so remember these words. Another time in the future, don't look back and blame me for not admonishing you. So this could be perfect advice for during Sesshin, for when we leave the Zendo, for meals or break periods. There are people who can do very well in the Zendo, but then they, when they leave the Zendo, they leave their practice, their awareness, their concentration, and just give way to all kinds of winds of thought. Sesshin is our best shot at this continuity and keeping it continuous and not having to come back and then pick it up all over again. Skipping here a few paragraphs. Among the enlightened adepts, being able to speak the truth has nothing to do with the tongue, and being able to talk about the Dharma is not a matter of words. This is typical of Zen style of not taking things literally, going beyond the literal. Clearly we know that the words spoken by the ancients were not meant to be passively depended on. Anything the ancients said was intended only so that people would directly experience the fundamental reality. Thus the teachings of the sutras are like a finger pointing to the moon, and the sayings of the Zen masters are like a piece of tile used to knock on a door. So this is a classic saying in Zen, don't mistake the finger for the moon. When you see someone pointing to the moon, don't look at the finger, meaning don't mistake the words for the reality. Don't mistake the words for the experience that they're pointing to. It's just a device. The words are a device to direct us to this realm of that is beyond words and concepts, like a piece of tile used to knock on a door. If you know this, then rest. If your practice is continuous and meticulous, and your application broad and all-pervading, and you do not deviate from this over the years, then you will mature in your ability to handle the teachings, to gather up and to release, and you will be able to see through petty things and cut them off without leaving a trace. See through petty things. Self-concerns. Gain, loss, fame, disrepute, praise, censure, pleasure, displeasure. And the big scale of things, these are petty. These are petty things. Not to mention the even more petty things that arise during the course of the day, or in Zazen, are taking offense at what someone has said, getting irritated, resentful. Zazen, especially Sesshin Zazen, reveals all of these things that can loom so large in our lives to be so insignificant, really, and looked at from a broader perspective. Then when you come to the juncture of death and birth, where all the lines intersect, you won't get mixed up. You will be clear and immovable, and you will be set free as you leave this life behind. This is deathbed Zen for the last day of your life. This talk about physical death, you could see as a kind of skillful means of upaya. Upaya is a very rich word. It means just that. It means coming up with ways to accommodate the teaching to the needs of the listener. And so there would be people who are very concerned about how they're going to die, how they will acquit themselves on their deathbeds. And so Yuan Wu here speaks to that. And for some people, this would help them get serious about their practice. But really, that's just a very limited way to understand the value of practice, something that'll help us as we're dying. I mean, it's important how we die in terms of our next lifetime. But what's even more important is now, this life. We don't have to wait to be tested on our deathbed. We're tested all the time. With every breath, we are tested as to our awareness, our presence of mind. I love this phrase, and I can't quite understand why. When you come to the juncture of death and birth, where all the lines intersect, you won't get mixed up. This is the danger as we're dying, according to all the teachings, is that we lose our awareness. We become mixed up, confused, and react to this huge transition, and that we specifically, we can get caught in different kinds of images that come to mind, sounds, sense experiences that are said to occur at death in a way that they would rarely. Maybe in a fever, you would experience some kinds of hallucinations and these kinds of things that could upset us. And so our practice then is a way of maintaining our composure, our detachment in the face of, well, yes, winds, more stiff winds. But of course, it's just as useful with the stiff winds we face in our daily lives. The difficult people don't seem to have the choice of getting away from, those difficult people whether it's at work or family members, the deadlines, the challenges of every kind, we're always being tested. The wonderful thing about this practice is it's not something we have to learn. It's not like a skill that we have to learn. This ability to maintain our aplomb in the face of difficult circumstances, this is a matter of unlearning the reactions that we have learned long in the past. It happens by itself. It is through serious daily practice. We recover this ability to maintain our center. There's no manual that's necessary. It's this, what we're doing now. In those circumstances, it's not learning that will help us. It's letting go of what we've acquired. Just moving along with the circumstances, the conditions as they change. Not setting ourselves against them, not fighting them. If you investigate and inquire diligently for a long time with single-minded concentration, the time of fruition will come. Suddenly the bottom drops out of the bucket and you will empty out and awaken to enlightenment. After that, you work wholeheartedly to weed out what's wrong and make sure of what's right for experiential proof of your realization. This is post-Kensho practice, to weed out what's wrong, because the mental, emotional habit forces are not so easily eliminated, and they keep arising even after a genuine awakening, and it takes time to slough off these stubborn habits of related to the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion. Then it will naturally be like a boat going downstream. No need to work at rowing. It's a nice image too. We get a sense of this late in Sesshin. Most people of just finally moving along with the current of change and allowing ourselves, surrendering to this mind that is so much more vast than our discriminating, controlling mind, giving ourselves up to this essential nature. But that kind of reward laid in Sesshin, it is the result of hard work before that. It takes a lot of work in the first day, second day, third day, fourth day of Sesshin. For most of us, a lot of work to get free enough to let go into the practice, to surrender to the practice completely and not try to manipulate things. Once you have attained the essential gist of the teaching, concentrate continuously so that there are no breaks or interruptions to enable the embryo of sagehood to grow and mature. Then, even if you encounter bad conditions, you will be able to melt them away with true insight and the power of concentration and fuse everything into one whole, so the great changes of birth and death will not be enough to disturb your heart. The great changes of birth and death, when you run across this in Zen texts, it always means great changes it just means change, the world of change, of letting go and allowing this current of change to move us. Birth and death, and when it's paired like that, means the world of samsara, the world of gain and loss. And all these other winds, so that will not disturb the heart. A Zen master once said, even strong winds are powerless to disturb the water of a deep well. We all get our chance to measure our abilities to maintain our center in difficult circumstances. If we live long enough, we're going to suffer losses, painful losses. How ready are we to face these? Cut off the myriad entanglements and make yourself free and untrammeled and reach the stage of great peace. When this is closely continuous without any leaks, this is what is called standing like a wall, miles high, lofty, and steep. Leaks is another word that we have as a translation in Buddhist text, allowing the clarity, the concentration to leak through our misuse of the mind, our attending to things outside us. After that, you come back to the world and respond to beings. Meaning, be ready to respond to what they need. Ready to help. Since there is never any sense of self, how could there be any realms of sound and form, of adversity and ease, of delusion and enlightenment? What is most difficult is to be perfectly at rest, not activating the conceptual faculty. If you are suddenly dragged off by it, you have leaked and tarried. You must continue to concentrate so that your mind does not wander off. After a long time, it will fuse into one whole. This at last is where you find rest. I remember hearing these kinds of teachings and feeling that it was such a remote thing, how how this mind can fuse into one whole when it felt so fragmented, so agitated, so riddled with self-concern, anxiety. But it happens. It happens if we persevere long enough through these difficulties, then it sort of sneaks up on us. Suddenly we find ourselves in this realm of profound peace. That is, so long as we're not trying to make that happen. It's all about putting our faith fully in the practice we're working on. Then the rest just unfolds on its own. We're just trying to get out of the way. And just let the mind settle into its natural state of rest, of silence. And then he finally says, from here you must still go on to master transcendent action. Again, this is integrating the experience that we have, integrating it into this world of commotion, turmoil, coming and going, deadlines and meetings and commuting. Another letter. In visiting enlightened teachers and questioning them, you must see essential nature and awaken to truth. As you directly forget feelings and put an end to views, you are inwardly washed clean. You become like a simpleton, not calculating gain and loss, not contending for superiority. Favorable or adverse, you cut everything off and don't let it continue. After a long time at this, you naturally arrive at the stage where there are no contrived activities and no concerns. This phrase is, you directly forget feelings, which means not clinging to feelings. Feelings are part of being human. We have feelings of one kind or another all the time. But Zen is just urging us not to attach to them, because if we don't, then they will just move on through us. We don't want to break the natural flow of the ebbing and flowing of our feelings. It's just like thoughts. Thoughts come and go. Get out of the way. Just let them go. Don't suppress them. We don't want to suppress feelings or emotions, but neither do we want to cling to them. And then put an end to views. This is another word that crops up in Buddhist texts quite a bit, views. We can understand views as opinions. We know in the Firming Faith in Mind, we chant, just let those fond opinions go. But they cover more ground. Views, the word view covers more than just opinions. It's any kind of notions about things, about ourselves, about others, about life or death or reality or anything. It's set views, things we've acquired that have become a kind of prism or a filter that prevent us from seeing things and seeing people as they are. And so we have from the Huayan Sutra, a very famous sutra, If you have no views, you can see. In other schools of Buddhism, they talk about right view. But ultimately, we say in Zen, ultimately, right view really is no view. Letting go of views. And this happens naturally as we let go of self. Thoughts of self. I have a passage here attributed to the Buddha talking about no self and views. As respects all sensation whatsoever, as respects all perception whatsoever, as respects all predispositions, past, future, or present, be it subjective or existing outside, gross or subtle, mean or exalted, far or near. The correct view in the light of the highest knowledge is as follows. This is not mine. This am I not. This is not my ego. Time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.